Hi, I'm James McIlvenny, and you're listening to the History and Philosophy of the Language Sciences podcast, online at hifilangsci.net. There you can find links and references to all the literature we discuss. In this episode, we're going to look at a major figure who spans the 19th and 20th centuries, and who's widely considered to have kicked off yet another revolution in linguistic scholarship, but a revolution whose effects are still directly relevant today. This figure is the Genevese linguist Ferdinand de Saussure. In the modern linguistic imagination, Saussure is a cultish figure who, in the mythologizing mode of history, is sometimes credited with single-handedly bringing about the structuralist revolution, which not only had a major impact on linguistics, but influenced scholarship right across the humanities and social sciences. But structuralism is a term that Saussure never actually used himself. In the coming episodes, we'll explore the genealogy of this term in greater detail, and the many senses that it took on. But in this episode, we're going to look at Saussure himself, his life and work. Saussure came from an aristocratic family from Geneva, whose members had distinguished themselves over generations in the sciences and arts. During his secondary schooling and in his first years at university in Geneva, Saussure pursued a very broad range of studies. The direction of his interests soon became clear, however. He would devote himself to the study of language. In 1876, Saussure went to Leipzig to complete his university studies and get a doctorate in linguistics. Leipzig was a natural choice. It was the world center of linguistics at the time. And as we'll recall from episode 9, 1876 is the year in which the neo-grammarian movement got started, when Brugmann went on a rampage in Curtius's journal. But as John Joseph describes in his 2012 biography of Saussure, Saussure never really became enamored of Leipzig and the scholarship that went on there. The older generation, represented primarily by Curtius, he found rather uninspiring. He also failed to be impressed by the younger neo-grammarians, such as Brugmann and Osthoff, whose courses he also attended. Saussure constantly felt that the discoveries the neo-grammarians were celebrating as great breakthroughs were obvious insights that he'd already had himself sitting alone in his study in Geneva. An episode from Saussure's time in Leipzig illustrates this point. In 1879, still only 20 years old, Saussure struck out on his own to publish his first book, in French, the Memoir, or Dissertation, on the Original System of Indo-European Vowels. Convinced that he'd solved fundamental problems in Indo-European linguistics, and perhaps worried that he'd be scooped by his teachers in Leipzig, Saussure wrote at a feverish pace and had each section of the book printed as he completed it. The result is a somewhat confusing work in which Saussure modifies his analyses on the fly. Later chapters of the book often modify and correct claims made in earlier chapters, which had already been printed and so couldn't be revised. I'll refrain from commenting on the obvious parallels to the way in which this podcast has come together. Saussure's memoir offers a radically simpler reconstruction of the vowel system of Proto-Indo-European than was generally accepted in his day. Saussure argues that Proto-Indo-European probably had only one basic vowel in stressed syllables, although this vowel would have had phonetically conditioned variants in some environments. According to Saussure, speakers would have originally not been consciously aware of these variants. Over time, however, they would have noticed these variants and reinterpreted them as indicating different meanings, such as signaling different tenses of verbs. In addition to the basic vowel in its two variant forms, Saussure also posited diphthongs in Proto-Indo-European that were formed through the combination of the vowel with what Saussure called sonant coefficients. These sonant coefficients are sounds like m, n, l, y, and w, which could both serve as the nucleus of a syllable or form a diphthong with the basic vowel. The many different vowels that we then find in the oldest attested Indo-European languages are supposed to have come about through the later evolution of the two variants of the basic vowel and the diphthongs. In some Indo-European languages, the sonant coefficients have disappeared from the diphthongs, but have left behind a main vowel that is somehow modified, such as having a different quality, stress, or length. In other cases, it's the vowel that's disappeared, leaving just the sonant coefficient behind to act as the nucleus of the syllable. Outside Germany, the system Saussure presented in his memoir was widely praised as a brilliant new analysis of Proto-Indo-European. Within Germany, however, Saussure's book was met with much less enthusiasm. Core features of Saussure's analysis had already been suggested by Osthoff and Brugmann. In fact, the papers in which Osthoff and Brugmann put forward these ideas were among those that they'd published in Curtius's journal in the inaugural assault of the neo-grammarian movement. But Saussure didn't cite Brugmann and Osthoff, leading to the criticism that he'd failed to adequately acknowledge his sources, and even the much more serious charge that he may have plagiarized his teachers. Looking back on this dispute, Saussure's defenders say that no plagiarism was intended. Saussure was merely treating the analyses and examples first published by his teachers as common knowledge in the field. One of the most innovative aspects of Saussure's analysis in his memoir is the way in which he made his reconstruction of vowels in Proto-Indo-European in terms of a system. That is, he imagined how all of the parts fit together to create a whole, rather than focusing on the reconstruction of individual elements. This notion of system would become one of Saussure's signature doctrines and is taken to be one of his chief contributions to the foundation of structuralism. The advantages of this thinking in terms of a system later received empirical reinforcement. Saussure, in his Proto-Indo-European vowel system, had direct evidence for most of the sonant coefficients that he posited. But he also hypothesized the existence of two additional sonant coefficients for which there was no direct evidence in any of the attested Indo-European languages. In 1880, the year after the publication of Saussure's memoir, the Danish linguist Hermann Møller proposed that the two hypothetical sonant coefficients in Saussure's system might correspond to the so-called laryngeal consonants, sounds like h or the glottal stop, that Møller posited in Proto-Indo-European. The most exciting twist in this story comes after 1911, when inscriptions in the archaic Anatolian language Hittite were finally deciphered. It became clear that Hittite was an Indo-European language, and that it had some strange sounds. In 1927, the Polish linguist Jerzy Kurjowicz demonstrated that the distribution of these strange sounds in Hittite seemed to correspond to the laryngeals proposed by Møller, which Møller tied to Saussure's hypothetical sonant coefficients. The legendary retelling of this story is to say that Saussure predicted the existence of laryngeals in Proto-Indo-European, and that this prediction was then later borne out by concrete evidence from Hittite. What in fact happened is that Møller's hypothesis, which he tied to Saussure's system, received empirical confirmation. But what we do see is that the conception of languages as systems, which was being applied directly to analyses in this period, increased the predictive capacity of linguistics. This ability to make accurate predictions is often invoked as a measure of the validity of the hard sciences. Saussure received his doctorate from the University of Leipzig in 1880, with a dissertation on a different topic, the genitive absolute construction in Sanskrit. With his doctorate in hand, he took up a position in Paris, where he taught for a decade until he was offered a professorship back in his hometown of Geneva in 1891. In Geneva, Saussure gave, over a number of years, courses in general linguistics, and it's for these courses that he's chiefly remembered today. The relevant courses were delivered at the University of Geneva in 1907, and in the winters of 1908 to 1909, and 1910 to 1911. What has come down to us from these courses is a little book with the title Course in General Linguistics, which was first published in 1916, 3 years after Saussure's death. The text is widely venerated as a foundational scripture of structuralism. But Saussure didn't write the published version of the course himself. It's a compilation of his notes for his lectures and the notes made by students who attended the lectures. These notes were edited into book form by two of Saussure's colleagues in Geneva, Charles Bailly and Albert Secher. In the latter part of his career, Saussure published almost nothing, but rather constantly reworked manuscripts in an effort to capture the perfect representation of his ideas. We might speculate that his caution in later life was a response to the backlash he faced in younger years, when he'd rushed his memoir into print, to a rather mixed reception. So Saussure's course is a short, suggestive text that leaves lots of room for interpreting and fleshing out the ideas it presents. Given the nature in which it was composed, compiled posthumously by two colleagues based on student notes, it's also a text that's open to challenge. We can always dispute if that really is what Saussure said. And indeed, there's a veritable cottage industry in the history of linguistics that produces competing interpretations of Saussurean doctrine. Whatever the details of Saussure's course, we can say that it puts forward a series of elegant conceptual distinctions that have become part of the general background to linguistic scholarship and continue to play a role in how linguists think about language today. Let's go on a brief tour of the course to see some of the key distinctions that Saussure set up. The first of these would have to be the distinction between la langue and la parole. These terms are generally used in their original French forms in linguistic texts written in English, but a rough translation would be the language and speech. Basically, la langue is the abstract system of a language to which all members of a speech community have access. It's the common possession that makes it possible for them to communicate with one another. La parole, on the other hand, is the application of la langue in specific instances to create utterances. Saussure also speaks of the general language faculty that all humans have and which allows them to make use of a particular langue. He usually refers to this as the faculté de langage, but he makes no consistent systematic distinction here. He sometimes uses la langue to mean language generally as an attribute of all humans. In the course, Saussure focuses most heavily on exploring the nature of la langue and has comparatively little to say about la parole. It's a matter of controversy whether Saussure felt that the scientific study of language should concern itself only with la langue, or whether la parole was also amenable to such treatment. We can, however, say that it's Saussure's concept of la langue that has had the most impact on subsequent scholarship in linguistics. According to Saussure, la langue is a system of signs. A sign has two sides, the signifier and the signified. The signifier is the mental image we have of the sound of the sign, and the signified is the idea contained within the sign. Saussure opposes his conception of the sign to the notion of a nomenclature. In a nomenclature, words are simply labels that name pre-existing concepts. The Saussurean sign, by contrast, exists only in the conjunction of sound and concept. The two sides, the signifier and the signified, cannot exist independently of one another. This brings us to the next key idea in Saussure's thought, the notion of valeur, or value. This is the idea that the limits of signifiers and signifieds are defined by their differences to all other signifiers and signifieds in the system of la langue. Saussure provides several examples to help clarify this point. In the case of signifieds, for example, there's no simple concept in the world named by the word. Saussure uses the example of the French word mouton, contrasted with the English word sheep. When a French speaker says mouton, they could be referring to a live exemplar of the species Ovis aries, or they could be referring to its meat. The English speaker, on the other hand, when they say sheep, can only mean the live animal. They'd have to use a different word, such as mutton, to refer to its meat. The point is that the different conceptual boundaries of these two words in French and English, mouton and sheep, are part of the respective language systems and not facts given in the world. The same principle applies on the side of signifiers. Saussure mentions the example of the sound written in French with the letter R. This sound can be pronounced in a range of different ways, and yet still be recognized as the same sound. For example, the French word roi, meaning king, can be pronounced with a uvular trill as r, or with an apical trill as r, or even with a velar fricative as ch, and yet it's still recognized as the same sound as long as it remains distinct from the m sound in moi, meaning me, or the d in doigt, meaning finger. But this range of variability permitted in pronouncing sounds depends on the respective language. While in French the sound represented by the letter R can be pronounced as a velar fricative, in German this is not possible. In German, the letter R is usually pronounced as a uvular trill, as in French, but the velar fricative is a completely different sound, which is usually written with the two letters CH as a digraph. So these sounds have different values in French and German. That is, they occupy different places in the system of each language. These differences in value are purely negative. Each item's place in the system of its respective language is determined by what it is not. There's no positive correlation between an element in the system and an absolute in the outside world. In the course, Saussure puts it like this. In a language, there are only differences without positive terms. Whether we take the signified or the signifier, the language contains neither ideas nor sounds that pre-exist the linguistic system, but only conceptual differences and phonic differences issuing from this system. In addition, Saussure points out that the system of a language exists at a particular point in time and can change over time. The linguist must first capture the structure of the language at such a specific point in time. That is, the linguist must first do what Saussure called synchronic linguistics, introducing a term that very quickly achieved general currency. Once the linguist has described particular synchronic states of the language, they can then compare these states to see the changes through time, thereby doing diachronic linguistics, also a term introduced by Saussure. So on Saussure's account, synchronic linguistics precedes diachronic linguistics. This, of course, represents a new orientation for the field away from the predominantly historical outlook of the 19th century. Saussure's radical notion of value is part of his doctrine of the arbitrariness of the sign. This is the idea that signs are entirely self-sufficient and not determined by anything in the external world. Even onomatopoeia, the classical case of words that appear not to be arbitrary, but rather motivated by the sound of the thing that they name, proves on closer inspection to be deceptive. Truly onomatopoeic forms are always to a certain degree conventional, in that they have to conform to the sound system of a language. But even these truly onomatopoeic cases are very rare. Most forms that we might take to be onomatopoeia are just as arbitrary as any other word in the language. An example that appears in the course is the French word for whip, fouet, which might seem to be imitating the sound of a whip. But if we look at the etymology of the word, we see that this is just a matter of chance. Fouet has developed by regular sound change from Latin fagus, which means beech, since historically strips of beech wood were used as whips. But Saussure did recognize that different aspects of language can be motivated to different degrees. For example, the word vingt, meaning 20, is wholly arbitrary, but the word dix-neuf, meaning 19, is not quite so arbitrary because it's composed of recognizable parts, namely dix, 10, and neuf, 9. It's 10 plus 9, and its structure is part of a regular pattern that occurs in other words with a related meaning, such as vingt-neuf, 29. This applies also to grammatical aspects of a language, such as word inflection. The plural form ships follows a common pattern with such words as flags, birds, books, and so on, although there are also less motivated forms, such as the plurals men and sheep, which don't belong to such a widespread pattern. So in our brief tour, we've just covered some of the core ideas presented in Saussure's course, which are classically understood to have revolutionized linguistic thinking. But how much of this was really original to Saussure? Saussure's doctrine of the arbitrariness of the sign is, of course, nothing new. As we've highlighted in previous episodes, it was a major topic of discussion in Enlightenment-era philosophy and had roots going back to antiquity. John Joseph, in his 2012 biography of Saussure, shows that Saussure would have been exposed to these ideas in his schooling in Geneva. Even though 19th century disciplinary linguistics, dominated as it was by German language philosophy, moved away from the traditional arbitrary conception of the sign, there were those who eagerly tried to reintroduce it into linguistics, such as William Dwight Whitney, as we'll recall from episode 8. Saussure, in fact, cited Whitney favourably in the course, and in a private note he scrawled in 1894, he commented that Whitney demonstrates that language is nothing more than a particular case of the sign. Whitney was not entirely alone in reviving older ideas about language in opposition to German language philosophy. Michel Bréal, Saussure's senior colleague in Paris, was propagating a similar conception of the sign in his writings in the second half of the 19th century. Bréal's work culminated in his 1897 book, Semantics, the work that established this term as the name of the subfield of linguistics that studies meaning. In this book, Bréal sketched a system of laws that supposedly govern the change of meaning in language over time. Even the Saussurean focus on the synchronic system of languages didn't come out of the blue. If we think back to Saussure's memoir, it was this approach of trying to piece together a systematic whole that drove his reconstructions. Saussure hypothesized sounds for which he had no direct evidence, because they would have to be there to make his system complete. This sort of systematic thinking was also a feature of the reconstructions put forward by Brugmann, which Saussure had been accused of copying. In his reconstructions, Brugmann used a kind of algebraic notation to indicate vowels he posited in Proto-Indo-European, without specifying their properties. That is, these symbols served as placeholders in a system. The caricature of 19th century historical comparative linguistics, and in particular the neo-grammarians, paints them as atomists, following individual sound changes through the history of languages without an awareness of the synchronic systems in which these sounds were embedded at each stage. While this picture might represent the general orientation of historical comparative work, it clearly doesn't capture the more innovative aspects of neo-grammarian scholarship. And the character of languages as systems was, of course, not unknown in earlier 19th century linguistics. The idea of system is a central pillar of the conception of language as an organism. August Schleicher, who we looked at in episodes 5 and 6, took the term organism literally and claimed that languages were a kind of living thing and was roundly criticized for this. But in the work of most other language scholars in this era, organism remained a metaphor that was invoked when the systematic character of languages was being stressed. Saussure himself uses the term organism in this sense in the course. And as Konrad Körner pointed out in a 2008 paper, many of these key features of Saussure's course are in fact not that far removed from Hermann Paul's Prinzipien der Sprachgeschichte, the neo-grammarian Bible that we introduced in episode 9. Although Paul insisted that the only scientific study of language was historical, he also made it clear that we need a description of states, that is, the synchronic stages through which languages proceed. These states have an organic character. In the Principien, Paul wrote, "The linguist will not be able to do without the description of states, since what he has to deal with is large complexes of elements that simultaneously lie next to each other. If this description is going to be a truly usable basis for historical observation, then it has to stick to the real objects, that is, to the psychic organisms that have just been described." But there's a significant difference in the metaphysical status accorded to these states of language by Paul and Saussure. We'll recall that Paul did not believe that there's such a thing as the grammar of a language, only the Sprachusus, the customary usage of a language community. The Sprachusus is an abstraction that the linguist makes through their analysis. It has no real existence of its own. Saussure, on the other hand, described la langue as a social fact, a term introduced by the French sociologist Émile Durkheim to describe entities that have an independent existence in society beyond the level of individual people. So we see that Saussure, although undoubtedly a very original and insightful linguist, was not necessarily the lone genius that he is sometimes portrayed as. We might agree with the assessment of Leonard Bloomfield, a leading American linguist from the structuralist era, who we'll meet properly in coming episodes. Reviewing the second edition of Saussure's course in 1924, Bloomfield concluded, "The value of the course lies in its clear and rigorous demonstration of fundamental principles. Most of what the author says has long been in the air and has been here and there fragmentarily expressed. The systematization is his own." In the next episode, we'll explore Saussure and his contributions to linguistics further, when we speak to Saussure's biographer, John Joseph.